Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics. This is in fact our 12th annual lecture, and it's been a series in which we've been able to invite and host a number of leading figures from Greece and beyond. We've hosted three of the most recent prime ministers, three or four economics ministers, several foreign ministers. We've had the patriarch from Constantinople, and we've had a very good array of speakers in this series. The observatory exists to encourage debates on Greece. We are, in one part, a research unit producing, we hope, high-quality research and contributions to public debate on contemporary Greece. But also, the Hellenic Observatory exists to provide a platform for public debate and discussion. And we've, in that context, been holding conferences, lectures, workshops, and seminars. In fact, this Friday, I can mention that we have a conference on social change in Greece, which will be in the Shaw Library this Friday, and you can get the further information from the web pages of the Hellenic Observatory. In fact, that is in the Wolfson Lecture Theatre in the new academic building. So those of you who go to the Shaw Library, if you could then go to the Wolfson Lecture Theatre, then you would find that more successful. So we have a number of conferences and lectures on different aspects. And in fact, if this evening's lecture whets your appetites, as it should, then let me say that we have a panel debate coming up on March the 28th, a Wednesday, entitled Can Greece Get Out of the Crisis? And for that panel debate, we will have the head of the Troika Mission to Greece, head of the Troika, Paul Thompson. We will have a former head of the Greek Employers Federation, Dimitris Daskalopoulos. We have the city economist, Vicky Price. And we have a lead person from Standard & Poor's Credit Rating Agency. So I think you could expect a lively evening from that panel debate. I don't think the panelists are destined to agree with each other. So do make a note that on Wednesday the 28th there will be that panel debate. So we've had a number of speakers in our annual lecture series. And for this year we thought we should focus, of course, on the biggest issue of all at the moment. And that is the economic crisis, the sovereign debt crisis, which has engulfed Greece, been a dominant focus for the Eurozone, and received international attention repeatedly for the last 2 to 3 years. And we're following the fashion of the moment, and instead of inviting a politician, we've invited an economics professor to speak here this evening. And we've invited a gentleman who is of international reputation. Professor Kostas Zariadis is the professor, the Malincroft Professor of Washington University in St. Louis. And he has published numerous articles in some of the world's leading economics journals, published a number of books, including a well-known graduate textbook. He's also a well-known blogger in the sense that he's one of the founding members of Greek Economists for Reform, a well-established blog, contributing much to public debate at the moment. I'm very pleased that our LSE colleague, Dimitris Bayonos, is also here. He's also connected with this blog, Greek Economists for Reform. And as is the usual practice, I'm going to invite Costas to speak in a moment for about 40 minutes or so, and this should then leave plenty of time for discussion and for question and answers thereafter. We should have a lively lecture, given the reputation of our speaker. I think he's got a very distinctive line of argument to convince you of, so I'm looking for a lively discussion thereafter. So, without further ado, if you could please join me in welcoming the 12th annual lecturer for the Hellenic Observatory series, Professor Costas Zariadis, to speak to us this evening. Thank you.
Well, good evening, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, guests. Thank you for coming. And today, this year's lecture, as you heard from Kevin, who I must thank for inviting me, is slightly unusual because professors typically do not appear in this event. So you will get a slightly different slant on events. You will get an outsider's view, less informed than that of insiders. But it'll be somewhat closer to what my true opinions are than insiders would normally disclose to you. So the topic today is, do we have a clicker or?
No, up and down, right?
Yep.
Okay, good, excellent.
So the topic today is Greece between austerity, reform, and the drachma. And as you know, the subject in question is becoming more and more important over time. There was an earlier version of this talk that I gave in Athens last July, and things seemed difficult but not as critical then. Since then, my thinking and the thinking of most observers about the situation has changed considerably. There's a lot of policy uncertainty about the issues we're going to discuss today. And there's a huge amount also of electoral uncertainty. And that makes it very easy for you to ask very interesting questions and very hard for me to give intelligent answers. So keep that in mind when question time arrives. So one of the things we observe is the absence of structural reform. The group of bloggers, Greek Economists for Reform, that many of us founded more than 2 years ago, and I must tell you that the ringleader of the group was Dimitris Baryanos, who was there in the second row. So he was kind of the person who had the idea to begin with. That was a group of people banded together and started listing interesting structural reforms that would restore economic growth to Greece. And 2 or 3 years ago, we thought there was a reasonable chance those reforms might pass, at least some of them. But there have been no reforms worth mentioning. The parliament has voted to change lots of things. Implementation has been slow. So the question is, why has there been any structural reform in Greece? And the answer typically is the special interest groups that impede reform. And that kind of, the uncertainty of reform forces us to ask some questions. And these are not easy questions to answer. One of them is, what is the immediate future of the Greek economy? And tonight, I'm not going to give you the average forecast or what I think are the most probable events. I'm trying to understand myself what may happen. And for that, one way to go is to prepare in your mind a list of things, of possible outcomes, and to prepare yourself for all contingencies. So tonight, what you hear from my mouth is not going to be what I think is most likely to happen, but it is roughly what is the worst case scenario. Just prepare yourselves and ourselves for what might ensue. So what we observe in Greece now, it almost reminds me somewhat of the changes that happened in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, and the transition economies in Belarus and Russia and Poland and some other countries. So what we see is the collapse of a particular form of socialism. The Greek version of socialism is unlike the Eastern European version of socialism in many dimensions. It's a socialism with high consumption, unlike the Eastern European countries. But like Eastern European countries, it's a socialism with weak incentives and little work. So what we're trying to figure out tonight is the consequences of standing pat, of continuing policies from the past into the immediate future. And that is consequences now. It's consequences 5 and 10 years from now. So one of the possibilities that we discussed in the blog many years ago, 2 years ago or more, was how much could GDP fall if current policies were continued? And 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, our consensus forecast within the group was perhaps 25% drop in GDP. Well, the worst case scenario is actually considerably worse than that, because already the falling GDP is about 16%, and by the end of this year, it will be 20. So the worst case scenario calls for a dip of about 50%, and we'll see why that's the case. And when you think about a magnitude of income decline as big as this, as fast as this, you have to think about humanitarian events. So what I read today in the latest news is that Cyprus is collecting food to send to Greece. So there's a possibility of a humanitarian crisis. And the possibility, the worst case scenario, is kind of too difficult to contemplate and too difficult to express. It requires not an academic economist. It requires the power of words that Sophocles could express much better than me and my colleagues. Nevertheless, Kevin tried to invite Sophocles, but he was not successful. So I have to do the work. So let's try and think, why are we facing this paucity of structural reforms? So one reason reforms are not being put in place is there's a huge amount of resistance from public opinion. I'm not just talking about interest groups. I'm talking about the man and the woman on the street. So if you look at polls, roughly 70 to 80% of respondents oppose all reforms and austerity programs. Of course, they want to stay in the euro. But on the other hand, they don't want reforms or austerity programs. And when these same respondents are asked about their voting intentions, when I wrote this, they expressed, 25% expressed a preference for the hard left and almost 30% for the moderate left. Now these numbers have gone further up with 30 and 35%. Virtually all parties, socialists, center-right, are opposed to any form of structural reform. They're opposed to smaller public sector. And whatever they do under pressure from the Troika. The people who are going to be here in a few days will have to explain this pressure. They They're opposed to private universities, for instance. They're opposed to privatization, deregulation, and any increase in competition. There is virtually no organized constituency for reform. There's no political party with a chance of being in parliament, no matter how small, who has it in its banner to engage in reform. It's kind of extremely strange because all the experts we know, the Troika, the Greek economists for reform, left-wing types like Stiglitz and Krugman, they all agreed, put your house in order. But there's no constituency in Greece for that. So what has happened in recent years is the government has cut expenditure a little bit, 2%. Actually, and last year, 2% relative to the top. And the last few months of last year, expenditure over the year of 2010 was going up at the rate of 6%. So public expenditure is going up partly because of unemployment compensation and the increase in the number of people unemployed. There have been large increases in tax rates, but large declines in tax revenue. In the first month of 2012, revenue is 7% below 2011. The closed professions, as I said earlier, remain closed, every one of them. Not one, closed professions opened. And labor unions seem to hold veto power over the entire public sector. That means that they're in a position to influence every major political party. So the question is, for tonight, questions are, well, we can ask them and we'll see what answers, how good the answers are going to be. One of the consequences of going on like this for another 5, 10, 15 years, and how likely is this continuation? And what happens at the end of it? Does Greece follow the recipe that comes from the experts and become a modern capitalist society? Does it become a bastion of idiosyncratic socialism? Or if like the worst of the worst, does it become a failed state? Okay, so let's, before we pronounce on the state of the patient, let's look at the vital signs. What are they? Well, some of them are state of public opinion, feelings of the people. Some of them are hard facts. We'll go over both sets. So one is that as a socialist state with a few capitalist elements, public opinion thinks the profit is stealing and that it's hostile to foreign investment. There's been very little foreign direct investment in Greece for many, many years. Laws, the administration of the laws is weak, and property rights are ill-defined. For instance, final adjudication of judicial cases averaged 7 years in Greece. There's a declining public order. There's a huge rise in crime rates, even though I was not able to find up-to-date numbers, but some of you might know them. There's an enormous frequency of strikes, and I'm not talking about the last year and a half or two. The frequency of strikes in the last 30 years before 2010 was major strikes, was 5 per week, 1 every working day. Every working day there's a strike, either a general strike or a sectoral strike. The average frequency of demonstrations in downtown Athens last year was 5 per day. The infrastructure and the education achievement of the country is that of a lower middle income country. Productivity is 80% of the European average. And you can find data like this from all sorts of sources. The
latest data, November, December, sometimes January, are kind of alarming. They show an economy that's falling at an accelerated pace. Industrial production is down 11%. The unemployment rate is 21%. The youth unemployment rate is nearly 50%, with all that implies for social peace. GDP last year was down 6.8%, and cumulative from 2007 was nearly 14.5%. Industrial production and retail sales are down almost a quarter from their peak. We can talk about anecdotal observations, but you all have those, so I will skip them and continue with the data. Even though productivity is 80% of the EU average, consumption was, at least in 08, 105% of the EU average. The value added in education is extremely low. So the education system doesn't work. I mean, this can be an anecdotal observation. You go around campus in Greece and see the physical appearance of the place by the numbers. Physical appearance of the place is not something unrelated to how good a job the place is doing. So the rate of return on tertiary education in Greece is half of what it is in most developed countries, 3.5%. I don't know a number as low as that, anywhere. There's an enormous shortage of skills and human capital. Invention and innovation are weak. If you judge by the number of patents granted or applied for, Greece is last in the European Union relative to its population by a large margin, almost an order of magnitude below other countries. Labor and product markets, as we all know, are highly protected. And despite all that, income inequality is very high and rising. There's 30% of people are below the poverty line. And it's a story of, it looks almost like a story of insiders, those with political connections, versus outsiders, those without. By that, I cannot really claim this to be a scientific fact. That's an anecdotal observation. It's friends of friends with connections and without. So what's going to happen in the short run? Bankruptcy. Anybody who looks at the national income accounts, which are the books of the whole economy, it's going to be hard put to argue that bankruptcy is not inevitable or almost inevitable. Remember, with Greek tragedies, there's at the end a deus ex machina. Okay? Somebody who comes and saves everything. So this could happen still. Germans might decide to bankroll Greece in perpetuity. But the nominal debt is 160% of GDP and rising, and GDP itself is falling very rapidly. So it doesn't really matter if some of it is going to be forgiven or not forgiven, because the number is going to go back to 160% within a couple of years. At a 6% interest rate, debt requires 10% of GDP for service. And since there are 1 million public sector servants and 1.9 million retirees, paying them even modest pensions requires 18% of GDP. So that's 27% of GDP right there. This is all of government expenditure. Default, in my opinion, is likely, even with zero public debt, even if public debt were to be completely forgiven, there's too few people who are producing and too many people who are consuming in Greece for this situation to be tenable. For those of you who are specialists in economics, there's something called the primary budget deficit, which is government expenses, government expenses minus government tax revenue, ignoring interest payments. That's already 3% and rising. And attempts to change this into a primary budget surplus by squeezing higher taxes from the economy are not going to work, simply because the economy is shrinking too fast. The tax base is shrinking faster than tax rates are rising. So yes, other people have defaulted, including Greece. Most recently, Argentina. Is the Argentina experience relevant? Probably not, because Argentina has a different set of trading partners and different set of natural resources. So what would Greece do outside the Eurozone? There's billions of euros in Greece. What's going to happen to those euros then? Right now, they are under mattresses in homes. They're going to coexist. If Greece goes to the drachma, it's not going to be a very easy thing to do. Maybe inevitable or highly likely, but it's not going to be an easy thing to do. Can the drachma coexist with the euro? Can the Greek government start printing drachmas to pay for its expenses? Does anyone? Will anyone accept the drachma in exchange? So those are the issues that come up. Now those are not very easy issues to think about. On the plus side, from the viewpoint of the Greek government has lost the ability to finance deficits by borrowing abroad. Adopting the drachma will let it do that again. So the government would save 8 or 9% of GDP in interest services. Also, it'll be able to perhaps draw another 5% of GDP as seniorage from printing money. So the total gain is 13% of GDP. But government expenses are close to 30% of GDP. So it needs a tax base. So what happens to the GDP? Will the economy grow back? So one of the things that people have pointed out is that there's going to be loss of foreign credit. That's one adverse circumstance. That letters of credit from Greek banks are going to mean squat. The banks will collapse. They're very close to collapsing anyway, already. And will be nationalized. But the banks will collapse whether Greece goes into the euro, the drachma, or stays within the euro. There's the chance of large public deficits financed by the printing press. But there were very large public deficits financed by foreign borrowing from the year 2000 up until 2 years ago. The deficit to GDP ratio could go high, as it was in the 90s and the 80s. Could go to 10%. It's possible that the EU, knowing that Greece cannot repay it, will forgive it. In return, Greece will be asked to surrender its vote in the European Union and might be asked to become a privileged partner. That's part of the set of possibilities. It's not the most likely event. It's only a possibility. Then the shrinkage of trade and the loss of trading access to the EU. A privileged partner doesn't enjoy as low tariffs as full partners. So the loss of credit and trading access to the EU will probably lower GDP by another 10 to 15%. If that happens, the unemployment rate will go certainly above 25%. It might go above 25% even without, even while Greece remains in the European Union, undergoes an internal devaluation as it is doing right now. So the unemployment rate can top 25%, 30%. There's massive immigration. The beginnings of it are there already. If when the Australian Embassy holds a seminar about life in Australia, it draws these days 1,000 or more people. 2 years ago, it drew virtually nobody. So people are making plans for immigration, and there's going to be a strong pressure. It's not there yet. There's going to be strong pressure to provide jobs in the public sector. And that's the most dangerous event that can happen. So there are no jobs in the private sector. Give us jobs. We are starving. If you see that, you will know that country is in for some rough going. So the public sector goes out, hires them. A scenario, 400,000 unemployed can be hired. particularly if banks are nationalized. How are we going to do that? By squeezing the private sector strongly. So right now, the number of public sector jobs to private sector jobs is 1 to 3. And if the government does that, it'll create 400,000 jobs in the public sector. It'll destroy twice as many in the private sector. The ratio of public to private jobs is going to go from 1 to 3 to 1 to 1. In other words, there's going to be 1.5 million public sector jobs, up from 1 million now, and then another 1.5 million private sector jobs, down from 3 million now. So the total number of jobs shrinks to 3 million. With 2 million unemployed, that's 40%. Then the cry goes up again. We need jobs. How do you need jobs? Nationalize everything in sight. So you offer jobs to all unemployed workers. You nationalize so-called large firms. Large firms are those who employ 50 or more people. Okay. So small entrepreneurs are the backbone of, quote, the backbone of the country, are still operating. So then, the current trend right now in Greece is that GDP will drop to the level that's consistent with infrastructure and the skills of the country. By infrastructure, I mean education, highways, governance, public order. And that level is the same as Bulgaria or Turkey. Actually, Turkey 2 years ago. But if the public sector grows larger, then GDP will fall even further. It'll fall to the level of Albania, or the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. The social consequences are anybody's guess, and I can give you no assurance what's going to happen. Class wars, xenophobia, withdrawal, complete withdrawal from the EU, nobody knows. So that's the doomsday scenario. Something that when I thought of about a year ago, I had to strive very hard to picture. But in the last couple of months, the symptoms of this scenario are becoming slightly more realistic. A year ago, I thought this was a 5% event. Now, I don't know what number I put on it, but it's much more than 5%. So, every tragedy has two important institutions outside the chorus and the protagonists. One of them is the scapegoat. Who is to blame for what the protagonists are suffering? The usual suspects. Speculators, various bad nationalities. Bad habits, politicians. And there's also a deus ex machina. At the end, when all is lost, somebody comes from high up and saves the day. And for the rest of this talk, which is another 10 minutes or something, can you? Five?
Ten.
Okay, so we're going to look for a miracle. If the war should happen, what chutes will open? How do you escape the burning plane? So Sophocles would have done this much better than me. Would have done almost everything better than me. But before growth starts,
Everybody talks about growth. But growth, there are no symptoms of growth in Greece. Nothing. There are no green shoots. Before growth starts, the first job, job one, is restoring confidence. How do you do it? Can the country make credible commitments to foreign investors, to its own citizens? Is the damage to its reputation, its will, irreparable? Well, Brazil had inflation, very large inflation, for many, many years before the 1990s. I was there in the 1980s, and the amount of inflation was incredible. And people were used to it. And when we talked about inflation being 9% or 10%, they didn't mean per year, they meant per month. Because that was the norm. So lots of things are possible, not probable. So how does the country wipe the slate clean? First of all, the voters have to understand they're responsible for the situation. Greece has been a democracy in the last 30 years, 35. Actually, all my life except for 7 years, plus two at the beginning or three. So they have to confess to themselves. Then they have to emit credible signal of change. And I can think of no better credible signals of change than a new constitution. Let's start over. But this one is not working. Then they have to see other things that I've never seen before. Change world means something really unusual happening, which is a flood of public works. Not 3 years from now, not 4 years from now, now. And there has to be a serious war on corruption. So these are things. New constitution, public works, war on corruption. These things are very easy to change. But the voter must look herself in the mirror and say, it's my fault, and I'm going to change it. I've been an alcoholic, workaholic, whatever. Tomorrow I'm going to stop drinking. Nobody can make you do that. You have to do that yourself. All right, so let's see how that might happen. And in the blog we've dealt these things. Dimitri and I and lots of other people have been debating these things for years and agreeing and disagreeing. So this is my version. It's not Dimitri's version. And my version is the most extreme. 100 MPs. Once we debated, we decided 200. Okay. 100 MPs with 12-year term limits. 12 years, you're out. You can never be reelected. You cannot work for the public sector ever again. Politics is not a career. It's an interruption of a real job. Public sector corruption, as we'll see, punished in a draconian manner. I will remind you who Draco was. A constitutional commitment to balanced budgets. No ifs or buts. Ironclad protection of FDI. Low taxation forever. 10-year revocation of employment security in the public sector. No tenure for 10 years. An abolition of the government monopoly on tertiary education. Okay, so this is. So what do we know about public works? Ports, airports, highways, particularly highways, marinas, financed privately, no contribution from the government, 99-year leaseholds on public land. Anybody can lease from the government for 99 years, develop anything they want after 99 years, or for that matter, 59 years, it goes back to the government. And you do all these things at the same time. You lease out highways all over Greece. You let out highways all over Greece and let the people who build them
collect tolls for a bunch of years. You do the same with ports, airports, marinas, everything. War on corruption. You defined it constitutionally as a high crime. Now most official corruption is a misdemeanor. It shouldn't be just a crime, it should be a high crime. No statute of limitations. This is, cases are prosecuted in specialized courts. And the punishment for the guilty is one that may drop or turn his grave and smile. Ostracism. Your wealth is expropriated. You lose your citizenship and your civil rights for life. And you're exiled for life in remote island camps. And then I was thinking about this last one. I said, in the Mediterranean, that's not no exile, this is vacation. So I thought, is St. Helena available?
Is what?
St. Helena. the island, Napoleon spent his life here. And if it's not, how about the Isle of Man? Windy, cold, you know, something like that. Scotland might not be part of the United Kingdom for much longer.
We'll offer you Scotland.
Scotland, okay. I hope Scotland agrees.
I hadn't realised this was a democratic argument.
Okay, so will there be a miracle? What is the chance? Well, in some sense, there better be one. The tragedy needs one. Youth unemployment is going to be a continual source of social eruption. Miracle is needed to lift the cloud of political uncertainty. Nobody wants to invest right now. Miracle is required to reverse the decline of law and order. And something is needed to allay or assuage the symptoms of a failed state. Well, has Greece done something like this before? Other countries? So, a couple of examples. I'll start with oh my God, the Asia Minor? Mm. It's Minor, O-R, Minor. The Asia Minor debacle. Those of you who know Greek history know that the Greeks were booted out of Turkey in 1922. And there was so what happened was the country sat around and understood that it made a mistake. This overseas colonialism was a stupid thing to have done. They assigned blame, perhaps not correctly, but they assigned blame. Six prominent politicians were shot, paid with their lives, for a mistake that Venizelos had done, the political opponent who made. Was the regime changed? The regime was changed. The king lost his job, and the country moved on. Okay? That was not the nicest way to do it, but it was done. And it can be done again. But before it is done, the voters have to look at themselves in the mirror, and they need to ask themselves some existential questions, what in Greece would be called ideology or philosophy. It's all about incentives, actually. So do they want a society in which some risks are taken, or the one society in which everybody is covered by a social safety net? We need to understand that in the first society, income will be probably 10 times as large as the second society. They need to decide if they want egalitarianism or enrichment. Will they allow some people, make it easy for some people who are very good at creating jobs and wealth to do so or not? The bottom line is, we have to decide between socialism and capitalism. Because public opinion in Greece is that you should have socialist organization of work
and capitalist consumption. And you cannot have both. You choose one or the other. So the public opinion is now at a crossroads. They are leaning left as we speak. But we don't know what's going to happen. It's very hard to predict. They have to sit down and think and make up their mind. And all I can forecast at this point is that this pondering of existential questions is going to take a while. This is not an issue that's going to be resolved in the next election. It'll take a few years. And that's as far as I'll go. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I find that a tremendously optimistic exaltation for the Hellenic Observatory. It seemed, if I may say, a kind of troika on steroids, as it were, but it seemed to be more troika than the troika. I'm going to open it up in a moment for the audience, but I wonder if I could start off with a couple of points of my own. I appreciate that you're painting different scenarios that might happen. But is the most effective way for Greece to come out of the euro, that is part of the argument, or just a risk?
It depends who you ask. I once published an article in the blog,
yes,
advocating, or at least tolerating, say, switch to the drachma.
And now?
I'll stand by that article. But all my Greek colleagues were of the other opinion.
Yes.
And all my foreign colleagues were of my opinion. So people, you read Krugman, Stiglitz, other bloggers, the idea is that Greece needs to go through a devaluation. An internal devaluation is very, very difficult. The standard way of regaining competitiveness is to get control of your currency, be in charge of your own money, and then you can lower the cost of your products very quickly. This internal devaluation, the squeezing of salaries by 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%, it's going to be painful, it's going to take a long time. Chief argument for remaining inside the euro is very simple. It imposes some discipline on Greek politicians. It makes it impossible for them to print money. And so they couldn't print money in the last 10 years, but they borrowed. They borrowed their little hearts out. So the Greece was under the drachma for a very long time. In my memory, especially when I was younger, there was quite a bit of fiscal discipline. It's not an issue of drachma versus the euro. In the long run, money plays a very weak role. I don't think Britain has lost a lot by being outside the euro. The question is, what is the internal structure of the economy? And on that's where the fight is. Do we make the economy more competitive? Do we make the economy more open? And that has very little to do with macroeconomic issues.
Okay, I appreciate that there's a debate with different aspects, but let me pursue one or two points more precisely, if I may. Given your emphasis on how the crisis has been get your emphasis that this political elite, this political establishment has borrowed and has mishandled the situation. What is the logic of giving this political elite the license to print money? That is that if this political elite is primarily, I suppose, responsible for the crisis, is the solution to give them the freedom to party every day, as it were. But let me pursue it a little bit further. You've very ably outlined different risks for Greece in the different scenarios. One of the points that you mentioned that Greece needed to get out of the crisis was the attraction of FDI. One of the points was to fund a massive extension of public works. One of the points was to avoid a social crisis. On what basis could we be confident that coming out of the euro, with the discipline imposed on errant politicians, lax politicians, on what basis could we assume that any of those things are more likely in the context of giving Greece its own drachma back, but in the context of tremendous uncertainty as to what would actually happen the day after a default? You mentioned about getting control back of your money. Is this a strategy to get control back of your money if the international financial markets are going berserk and there is a contagion effect across the Eurozone or risk of instability? Is this a way of regaining economic freedom, regaining control of your money, if you take Greece out of the constraint of the euro and allow the financial markets to do their worst? It's just an easy question to start off.
Well, actually, Kevin, this is several easy questions, one after the other. I think I understand your reluctance to hand the printing press to a political class that has brought Greece where it is now. But perhaps we should ask a prior question. Should this political class be in power and control of anything, not just the money? One advantage of changing the constitution is that you can get rid of them. And if you do, you can bring forward another class of politicians. If you like, you can call them technocrats, call them any other name you like. And they would be bound by a different ethic. It is simply naive, in my view, to entrust the recovery of Greece to the people who are responsible for the spread of the current disease. That's one. Now, exactly how, you ask several other questions, and I'm trying to duck a few, because they're very difficult. But your other question, I think, is also very interesting. The last one, that if there's a Marshall Plan for Greece, how is it going to be administered? Who's going to do it? And do you want to empower these politicians or not? One advantage of building infrastructure through private investment, FDI, is to avoid the heavy hand of the state. I cannot imagine Greek politicians in this political class being handled $100 or $200 billion in infrastructure funds and actually doing a good job of investing it. It must be done by another group of people completely. And private construction consortia is one possible way of doing it. But otherwise, you don't.
But I'll finish on this last point and then bring the audience in. But if the Greek record of attracting FDI has been so lamentable, why should a foreign investor be more likely to put money into Greece when it's just come out of the drachma and the financial markets are going berserk?
Well, financial markets going berserk is a lower possibility. Of course, prediction is very difficult, especially of the future. but financial markets are unlikely to go berserk. I would not bet my house on this prediction. But it seems that Italy and Spain are less likely to get the bug from Greece than they were even 6 months ago. So the rest of Europe is a bit insulated. So this is not going to happen. I also remember when I was a young man, many years ago, the Greece under the drachma attracting in the 50s and the 60s considerable amounts of FDI.
Under the Bretton Woods system?
Not in the Bretton Woods system. It attracted under the drachma, and the drachma was for a while stable under the Bretton Woods system, and then it's kind of slowly drifted because of inflation. By the way, the exchange rate of the drachma to the dollar and other currencies between 1953 and 1973 was completely stable. So it is possible with the right people in power to operate under the drachma. It'll be easier to operate under the euro, but if the people in power are very bad, then even the euro is no guarantee.
Okay, but exchange rates stable with the Bretton Woods system, with huge American investments and dodgy politicians ending it in dictatorship. It's not...
There's some words that I cannot debate.
Okay.
And the D word is one of them.
Okay, let me open it up to the gentleman right at the very back. Thank you, yes. If you could briefly say who you are and then give the question, please.
Camille Kovar from LSE. I wanted to ask you if somewhere along your doomsday scenario you see the chance for Greece to become a phoenix and be born again with different institutions as a country. Thank you.
Well, the phoenix...
Take several questions, because there's going to be a number.
Yeah.
If you could...
Sure.
Is there someone to come right down to the very front here, please? Right to the very front. Brilliant. Can you wait for the microphone?
Bernard Casey from Warwick University and the Hellenic Observatory. In your analysis, Greece has been, in one sense, completely isolated from the outside world, because if some of your scenario starts to develop, that is going to have knock-on implications for other economies. If Greece defaults, other European economies are much, much more likely to default. And here I wonder about your deus ex machina. The deus ex machina is the fact that nobody can afford to let Greece default, because although Greece could default by itself, it cannot default by itself. It will have a knock-on. So the deus ex machina is stopping the contagion. It's not necessarily just dealing with Greece.
Thank you. And then could we take the lady here, please?
Hello, my name is Ksenia. I'm from Delft University of Spain, but I'm Ukrainian, so I'm actually from the Eastern European countries. And I have for you a macroeconomic question. The question is about, do you think that the global relocation of producing forces like factories contributed to the global crisis? For example, all European factories, American factories have been moved to China, so that's why people have nowhere to work, but they want to consume more. So do you think this contributed to the global crisis and also to Greece's crisis? Thank you.
Okay. So will Greece be reborn? To tell you the truth, I don't really know. It certainly was reborn in 1922. And other countries have examples of economies rising out of their ashes. Okay? We have examples of economies going down and coming back. There are many of these examples. The infrastructure of Greece does not bode well for the chance of rebirth, but the entrepreneurial skills of small Greek businessmen work in the other direction. So it kind of depends what structure small and mid-sized businesses will be given, what incentives the state will allow those who are able to create wealth and jobs. If the right incentives are given, then I have very few doubts. My doubts are whether the economic structure itself will promote economic growth or will hold it back like it is now. The second question is there going to be a contagion from Greece to Spain and Italy, and that's again hard to predict. Contagion sometimes appears an irrational event, but it's not totally irrational. It also depends on fundamentals. As Greece cannot contaminate the Netherlands, no matter how hard it tries, because the fundamentals of the Dutch economy are very strong. Could Greece contaminate Italy and Spain? I think the chance that it contaminates Spain is low, because the fundamentals of the Spanish economy, at least the government accounts, are decent. Can it contaminate Italy? No, because Italy is willing to take and implement reforms. To the extent that you see Monti being successful in his reform program, then you should think that the chance of contagion is small. If Monti is unsuccessful in his reform program, then the chance of contagion is larger. So I think the jury is still out on contagion. I think the chance is not as large as we thought 6 months ago. And the last question is, does increasing mobility of capital, factory relocation, outsourcing, and things like that contribute to the global crisis and to the Greek crisis? And the answer to the first question, the global crisis, unquestionably yes. Higher mobility of capital does two things. One is it increases global income. Income for the world in most countries goes up when capital is more mobile. But the downside of that is that capital increases world income by seeking where the returns are higher, not investing at home. Your capital is not patriotic the way labor is patriotic, because labor is hard to move. Okay. So you have to take the good with the bad. You want higher income and more unstable jobs, or do you want stabler jobs, like in the old Soviet Union, at very low income? So it's a choice that we'll have to make, Greece above all.
Okay, thanks. More questions? The gentleman in blue here.
When Paul Volcker was here last year speaking at the LSE, he said that he was wrong about the euro. And it was very obvious to him now that basically you couldn't have a monetary union without a fiscal union. And is there anything that's happened within the eurozone within the last year that has shown that any of the leaders are prepared to address that? That's the first point. And the second point is very quick, very brief. Isn't a general election in Greece a very damaging distraction? And it's not going to help the situation at all, is it?
Thank you. And sorry, right at the very front here, please. Okay. And then the gentleman right at the back afterwards.
Dimitris Papadimitriou from the University of Manchester. I enjoyed the talk very much, and I think there would be very few people in this room that would not share your passion for reforming Greece. Where I become a little bit more skeptical than you as a political scientist is that very often reform-minded people like you and others, particularly economists, I may say here, always fantasize reform without politicians or with an imaginary class of politicians that they are not corrupted, they are better, they can do things better than the previous corrupt order. The problem with this thinking, and this is perhaps where history and political science can help us understand the problem better, is that political elites never disappear. We have no example, not even Greece after the Asia Minor disaster, where political classes are annihilated. Political classes are reborn, they're recycled. So you never get the perfect clean break that many people assume. Neither do we ever have an example where uncorrupted technocratic elites landed from the moon in one country and made it all better. The question then becomes, how do you use your existing political capital to to instigate this reform that we all of us agree with. And here I have a disagreement with you and many others who collectively dismiss the Greek political classes as being unworthy of our attention and ready to go home. The reality, I think, is more complex than this. And the question here is how you encourage the political system to reform, not by creating a reform-minded party that will do things right. Because for every reform-minded party you have on one hand, there needs to be an opposition. And if you get all the reform-minded people in one basket, the opposition will be something very unpleasant. But we all know that in democracies, oppositions come round and at some point become government themselves. So I won't go too long here. All I want to say is a word of caution. Be careful with how you fantasize this reform process and who is likely to lead it. Thank you.
Thank you. Then at the very back, please.
Hi, Constantine Demetrio. I'm a tutor at Queen Mary. My question basically is, from my reading during this crisis, considering the global flows of capital, for one thing, that the young lady mentioned, and also the fact that the banking system seems to be having a bit of a feeding frenzy on one country after another, I know you seem to think that this is not going to continue, but I have a different opinion. How would that affect any change that would happen in Greece? Going to the drachma, staying within the euro, and that sort of thing. Thank you.
Okay. They keep asking difficult questions. Well, can there be a monetary union without a fiscal union? Realistically, no. Trivially, yes. So you don't need a fiscal union between Austria, Finland, the Netherlands, and Germany, because the fiscal policies are already aligned. The economic structures, political structures are similar enough. So you need a formal fiscal union among them. But you do need one fiscal authority that covers both Greece, Southern Europe, and Northern Europe. And that's very, very difficult to do because it involves the surrender of sovereignty. So the progress that European leaders are making in this regard is very slow, and I don't think I'm optimistic for more rapid progress. So maybe Paul Volcker was wrong initially and is more right now. Is the general election in Greece a distraction, or is it necessary? I think it's necessary, and I'll explain in a minute, but I'm not sure it's sufficient. It's not a distraction because governments in Greece are called on to make huge changes to liberalize the economy back where it was in 1970 or 1960 and take all those layers of socialism and government intervention that were built up in the last 30 or 40 years, take away the privileges of many, many social groups. And for that, they need a mandate from the people. They need a clearer, strong mandate. And my doubt is whether the next election, or the one after that even, will give them that mandate. But they can try nothing without a mandate, and a mandate they must seek. And let's hope they will get one in the not too distant future. Perhaps not this time, but the next one. Then to Dimitri. Is reform needed? Do economists fantasize about these reform balls? Here I take my cue from the other Dimitri. So that maybe you too can actually eliminate me and debate it amongst yourselves. Are economists making unrealistic assumptions about politics? Certainly we make simplifying assumptions about politics. Can we annihilate the political class?
I hope you can annihilate this one. We cannot annihilate every political class. There's one in New Zealand. There's one in Singapore. They govern much, much better than Greece. If I am to believe Transparency International, that's the only data that I have about quality of governance. The quality of governance in Greece has fallen very rapidly in the last 10, 15 years. And if only we could improve the quality of governance in Greece to the level of Cyprus, Greeks and Cypriots are kind of culturally close, it should not be completely impossible to do that, right? Then the benefits to everyone would be enormous. And then what about the banks and the speculators attacking sovereign debt? Well, as we speak today, my graduate class is going to take an exam tomorrow, and don't tell them. I'm going to disclose the topic. The topic is you write down an economic model, and you ask them to give realistic values the parameter. And the question coming out of this model is, what is sustainable debt to GDP ratio? What is sustainable deficit to GDP ratio? Any economic model that you use that allows a ratio like this to exist gives you numbers that are close to and lower than what the Maastricht Treaty speculates. It is impossible for Greece or Italy to sustain a debt to GDP ratio of 120%, let alone 160%, without running a huge primary budget deficit, the budget surplus, sorry, of the order of 10%. So simply, you can attribute the foibles of European sovereign debt to speculators, to feeding frenzies. But the fact of the matter is, economic theory tells you they are trying, the governments in the south of Europe, and even in the north of Europe, are trying to sustain debts that are unsustainable. You cannot keep it there. Something has to give. And now I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment, and I won't tell you what I think has to give.
Perhaps time for a couple of more final questions. Here, please. Yeah?
Thank you. I'm Ting from China Business News. I have two questions. The first one is, there is a huge debate in China about whether China should help Greece and Europe in general, because the notion of a developing country helping a wealthy nation is seems very strange for both Chinese and some of the Europeans. So I want to know your feeling on this regard. And the second question is, could you comment on the Greek PSI, the program, and its impact on the CDS market? Thank you very much.
Then here, please,
I
have to be the last question.
Ian Begg from the European Institute at LSE. One quick comment first, which is that Japan seems to survive with a debt of 200% or 220% of GDP without collapsing, and the US has a higher debt to GDP ratio than Europe as a whole. But my question is a different one. Latvia has been through as deep an economic crisis as Greece and seems to be recovering. Portugal seems to be on course to at least meet the obligations of its adjustment program. Ireland similarly has done so. So my question to you is there something uniquely problematic about Greece, Greek politicians, or the Greek people that means that they can't do something similar?
Okay. Anything else? Should we take another one? Or?
Yeah, just one more. Gentleman here in the yellow tie, please.
Hi, Andreas Kutras. I've got a comment first on Asia Minor. As I come from, both of my parents were refugees. It was not actually a catastrophe. It was an influx of skilled workers who actually wanted to work. Okay, the 1.5 million people who came to Greece in 1923 actually boosted the economy. So it was a quite different catastrophe in there. Now, with regards to the political elites that were mentioned, there was a very, very fine evolutionary process the past 30 years in the politics of Greece. And that was very simply, those politicians that were, let's say, the bad ones, were able to deliver the promises time and time again, and as a result, were re-elected time and time again. And the ones who were, let's say, let's call them the prudent ones, were pushed out of the parliament time and time again, basically because of the subsidies and the free money that Greece was getting with no strings attached by the European Union. So we have created a political system, a political elite, through an evolutionary process over the past 30 or 35 years. If you do remember, as I do, I'm quite old enough, the politicians that inhabited the parliament in the 70s or in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, you could actually say that these were quite interesting, if not acknowledged politicians of people. Whereas if you actually look at the politicians that we have now in the parliament, it's like a doghouse. Okay. So there is an evolutionary process.
Let's have a question, because we're desperately short of time. What is the question?
The question is, have you ever thought about the Brazilian fiscal responsibility law that was passed in 2001 in Brazil? Since you've been to Brazil, you probably know about it, which actually forbids politicians who stray from their budgetary constraints to be actually up for re-election the next time round.
Okay, let's try to do this in reverse order. Fact of the matter is that the situation in Greece since after 1974 was special. One off thing not to be repeated, Greece received subsidies from the European Union in the last 30 years equal to one GDP, 1 year GDP, and borrowed another year's GDP. So the country had a party, and this party's over, and that's the problem. I'm also going to remind you, without addressing the Asia Minor debacle, that there have been politicians over time in Greece in difficult circumstances, like Venizelos and especially like Trikoupis, were actually reform politicians, and they reformed a lot. Circumstances called for it. What about Japan and the US having so much debt? I'm wondering about Japan myself. Once the Japanese people are notorious for not buying foreign securities, once they wake up to the possibilities of foreign securities, it will be very difficult to sustain Japanese debt. The US is a safe currency. It's a safe haven. Japan, to a certain extent, is the UK. And if you are perceived as having a tradition of very safe debt, proven tradition of never having defaulted on that debt, then your debt becomes much more desirable than other countries. Rates. Why is Greece driven from Latvia and Ireland and Portugal? Well, the humorous answer is that it's the country that invented tragedy. It wasn't invented in Latvia, Ireland, or Portugal. But the Greek economic structure is much weaker on incentives to create wealth. It's in crude terms much more socialist, much, much more distorted than Latvia, Ireland, and Portugal. And after this is over, if you stay around, I'll be able to give you very simple examples of how this works. So the economic structure is not conducive to a quick turnaround of the economy. And last, the question about China. Is the Greek PSI going to be successful? Is the CDS going to be triggered? Your guess on this one is as good as mine. I would say 50-50. If the PSI is unsuccessful, that's 50-50. Then CDS will have to be triggered. Now there's a question of how much is going to be paid out, but it'll be triggered. If it's not, if it's successful, then there's going to be some problems down the road. And as for China helping Europe or Greece, is that a good idea? Well,
this is just between you and me. I don't want anybody else to hear this. But China and Greece are the two most civilized countries in the world, as you know. Between themselves, they created single-handedly something called world culture. And they have a special relationship to take care of each other. And if China helps Greece in this difficult juncture, the next time China goes into trouble, the Greek people will save whatever is necessary to bail out China.
Eventually, we squeezed optimism from you, didn't we? Okay, we are now out of time, but on your behalf, I'd like to thank our speaker and you, the audience, for the discussion. Thank you very much indeed.